Why don't we just begin in the Word this morning? I'd like to invite my son, Braden, to come up and share the Word with us. And start right there and read to right there.
Jesus reinstates Peter. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Again, Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus had asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, and you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me."
Very good. Thank you. This is the Word of God, read by a child of God for us, the people of God. Amen. As I said earlier, we are a part of a church who values the next generation now, and we believe very much that we're not raising a generation to lead us in the future, but that if we watch the younger generations, they're actually leading us now into the presence of God. And so I'm thankful for our children's choir. I'm thankful for my son, Braden, who's willing to come and read the Word this morning. And I asked Braden just before we left the house if he would read for us this morning. And I had him look at it one time, but basically invited him to come up here cold and just read it. And I asked him because I knew he would do it. And I knew he would do it because he loves me. Because he loves me, he'll do the things that I ask him to do. And he would take that as an opportunity to show me that he loves me by coming up here and reading our passage this morning for all of you. What are the things in your life that you've done to show people that you love them? Maybe you've given something up in your life for someone that you care about. Maybe you've taken on things in your life, things that you never said you would do. Maybe you find yourself doing dishes. Maybe you find yourself cleaning and dusting a house, and you said, "I will never do those things." But love has a way of making us do really funny things. Maybe you've given up tickets to your favorite sporting event because your spouse or your significant other said, "I think I'd rather you stay home." We do crazy things for love. What are things that you have done for love? What are things that you have done to show people that you love them? It's not a ridiculous question because we do ridiculous things to show people that we love them. People get tattoos of the name of the person they love. You have to be careful there because you better be sure that that relationship is permanent, because tattoos are. It can be really difficult to turn the name Sarah into Elizabeth. Maybe you have found yourself giving up a hobby, taking on responsibility. Maybe you're like this guy that I read about this week in an article who loved his high school sweetheart so much that when they finished their first year of college at separate schools, he found out that she was going to Russia to study abroad, and he thought, I'll go to Russia. So he began to make plans to study abroad, had no interest in the language or the culture, only interest in this girlfriend of his. Well, she broke up with him in March. And he said, rather than saying, okay, I probably shouldn't go to Russia, he said, what better way to win someone back and prove my love for them than to go on and go to Russia? So he goes to Russia, single, ends up getting put in a home with a crotchety 80-year-old woman who spoke very little English, seemed very unexcited about having a house guest for 8 weeks. In the course of their time there, his ex-girlfriend met a Russian fellow and began to date him. So our protagonist did the natural thing, and that is to befriend this Russian guy so that he could be close to his ex-girlfriend. He said it was the worst 8 weeks of his life, as you can imagine. At the end of 8 weeks, when it's, thank you, finally time to come home, he goes to the airport and can't figure out where his flight is. And I tell you what's happening right now. He can't figure out where his flight is and realizes that he is at the wrong airport. A cab driver is willing to help him out for the low rate of $100. And this guy has to say, I don't have any other options. So he spends almost all of the money that he has left to go to this other airport, only to find that there's a problem with his visa, and he has to stay in Russia for 3 more days while they sort it out. He goes back to the 80-year-old woman's house to find that she's gone. He calls her, and she said, I'm on vacation. I left the house right after you, and I won't be back for a month. He spends the next 3 days, he says, sleeping on a cold beach in a 24-hour bookstore and a train station before they finally tell him that he has to go back to the airport where all of his luggage is. And he says at the end of the article, 5 years later, I'm just about over her. Now, maybe you've never done something quite that crazy in the name of love, but we do crazy things for love. What have you done? What are you willing to do? How do you show those that you love that you, in fact, love them? How do you make it apparent to them? Would you defend someone you love? Would you give your life for someone you love? Would you build a shelter for someone you love? Would you offer correction to someone you love? Would you jump out of a boat for someone you love? Peter did. Peter has done all of these things. When Jesus was arrested in the garden, when they came to find him and take him away, Peter takes out his sword because he is upset that the one he loves is being arrested. And it says that he cuts off the ear of one of the servants who was in the crowd. A great gesture, but terrible aim. Jesus heals the man and tells Peter to put away his sword. Peter committed to Jesus in a way that none of the other disciples did. He said at the Last Supper, Jesus, even if everyone else leaves you, this is as Jesus is talking about what he will suffer and what he will have to go through. And Peter says, look, I don't know about the rest of these guys, but I'm with you. I'm with you till the end. Even if I have to go to death for you, Jesus, I'm willing to do it. Peter flees just like the rest of them. But the thought was there. when Jesus was transformed before his eyes on the mountain in the transfiguration, when Peter caught a glimpse of Jesus' glory, he said, "It's good for us to be here. Jesus, let me build a tabernacle or a shelter for you and Elijah and Moses, who are there also." Peter's willing to care for Jesus in that way. Peter's willing to rebuke Jesus when Jesus begins to talk about the suffering that he will face. And Peter says, "No, no, not you. That's not how it's going to go. Jesus, that's foolish." And Peter was willing to jump out of a boat for his love for the Lord. If we jumped back up a little earlier in chapter 21, afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. It happened this way: Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. "I'm going out to fish," Simon Peter told them, and they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved, that's John, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his garment around him, for he had taken it off, and jumped into the water. Peter didn't even wait for them to bring the boat ashore. He grabbed his clothes and just jumped into the water when he realized that it was Jesus standing on the shore. He jumped in and swam to Jesus because he needed to be near him again. He needed to stand face to face with Jesus once more. I wonder if he thought about the first time that he got out of a boat to come to Jesus. I wonder if he thought about that moment when he saw Jesus walking on the water and Peter called out to him and said, "If it's you, tell me to come to you on the water." And so Jesus says, "Come." And Peter takes only a couple of steps before fear takes over and he begins to sink. I wonder if that was running through his mind as he was jumping out of the boat. I wonder if Peter was thinking of all the things that he had experienced with Jesus, all of the things that he had seen Jesus do, the things that he had heard Jesus say, the way that he taught, the way that he loved people, the way that he healed people, the miracles he performed. I wonder if Peter thought about that name that Jesus gave him. "You will be called Peter, Kepha, rock. And on this rock, I will build my church." I wonder if that's running through Peter's mind as he's swimming to shore. I wonder if he's thinking about his betrayal as he's swimming to shore. I wonder if he remembers just a few nights before standing by that fire in the courtyard while Jesus was being put on trial for crimes he didn't commit. And Jesus and Peter is being questioned by a servant girl who says, aren't you one of the ones that was with Jesus?" And Peter says, "No, I don't know him." And she says again, no, you were with him. You were one of the ones that followed him." And he says, no, I don't know him." She asks a third time, and the third time it says that he calls down curses and says, no, I don't know him." And he hears the rooster crow, just as Jesus told him he would, that he would deny him three times before the rooster crowed. And Peter hears that and runs away in shame. I wonder if he's thinking about that denial as he's swimming to shore. Or maybe all he is thinking about is the fact that Jesus, the one he loved, is standing on the shore, and all he wanted was to be near him. And so he jumped out of the boat because he couldn't get there fast enough Jesus was waiting, and Peter had to get there. Jesus was waiting. Jesus is always waiting. He's always waiting for us to jump. The moment when you are ready to jump, Jesus is standing there waiting. The moment when you find hope has begun to creep back into your life as you read these words or as you hear the gospel proclaimed, the moment that you are willing to consider this for the first time or the moment that you are willing to consider it again, the moment that light has begun to creep back into the dark places in your life, the moment that you feel like maybe, just maybe, I could be forgiven. Maybe I'm willing to trust this love. Because every other love I've trusted has let me down. The moment that you come to that place and are ready to jump, Jesus is waiting. He's always waiting, ready to receive you. Ready to invite you back into his presence. So jump. Meet Jesus on the shore. Maybe for some of you this morning, that's it. You just need permission. Just go ahead and step out of the boat. Jump. Jesus is waiting. And that's true. It's always true of Jesus. It will always be true of who he is. It's that gift of grace that we have a hard time understanding because it's free. And yet it cost him so much. But I'm afraid that we have this tendency to stop at just being boat jumpers. At just being people who over and over feel like we're responding, we're having a knee-jerk reaction to that moment of realization or revelation or that moment when we're willing to receive grace again. We tend to allow ourselves, or to live life, I should say, in such a way that for many of us it just feels like a roller coaster of defeat and shame and guilt. And then we are reminded that Jesus offers us grace, and we're reminded that he is waiting for us and wants us to come back. And so we come back and we experience that and we jump again, and we feel like we're in the presence of the Lord and something new is happening in us. And it's not too long, though, before we start looking back at the boat and say, you know, the things in the boat, at least they were comfortable. I could go and get back in the boat. I could find myself back in that place that Jesus called me out of. And so we too often find ourselves in this cycle of victory and defeat and victory and defeat and victory and defeat. And so all we do is just keep jumping out of the same boat. And that's not all that Jesus has for us. Does he desire that moment when we respond? Absolutely. That moment when we realize there's something different about what he is offering than what the rest of the world is offering, and we're willing to respond. But there's more. There's more that Jesus wants for us than simply to keep jumping out of the same boat. And in this encounter that we see with Peter, we find that Jesus is calling him to something more. Did he appreciate the fact that Peter jumped out of the boat, that he wanted to be the first one there? I bet he did. I bet it made him proud of this one that whose faith he had commended. The one who made this really strange sounding promise. On the faith that you displayed, that's what I'm going to build my church on. So did it make him proud? Did he feel the love that Peter was trying to show him in that moment? I bet that he did. But after they've eaten, because when they landed and hauled these fish in, they saw a fire burning coals there with fish already on it. As they toiled all night, Jesus, you know, I don't know, what does he just call the fish out of the water? Has them hop on the hot coals. He has breakfast waiting for them. And they have a meal together, like they've done so many times. And then we see Jesus and Peter. It says when they'd finished eating, Jesus said to Simon, "Peter, son of John, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Again, Jesus said, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" He answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Take care of my sheep." The third time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" He said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." There's debate around the language that's used here for love. And it's a perfect opportunity to preach about our understanding of love and the way that we say we love someone, and then we also, you know, love pepperoni pizza, that we surely can't feel the same way about both of those things. I mean, maybe, you know, pizza is a close second, but that's not the way that we want to approach it this morning. There's also debate about why Jesus asks Peter three times, "Do you love me?" And that seems a little clear because Peter denied Jesus how many times? Three times. So maybe he's wanting to recall that. Maybe he's wanting to bring that to Peter's attention. And then there's this thing that Jesus says kind of in the middle there, "Do you love me more than these?" What are these? Three possibilities. Do you love me more than these nets and these boats? Do you love me more than these disciples love me? Or do you love me more than you love these guys that you are fishing with? It's difficult for us to know which of the three that it could be, but I think that there is something for us to learn if we look at each of them. Because Jesus is asking us the same question. Do you love me? "Yes, Lord, I love you." Maybe you've said those words to him. "Jesus, I love you." Maybe he's waiting for you to say those words. But do you love me more than these? Peter, do you love me more than you love these nets and these boats? Do you love me more than this life you've always known? That's a question for you to consider. When you think about what does it mean to respond in love to Jesus, the one who loved us so much that he gave his life? Do you love me more than you love these? Do you love Jesus more than you love the life that's comfortable, the one that you always tend to gravitate back to because it's easy, because it's a place that you've had success, because it's a place where things are familiar to you? It was not surprising that Peter and the disciples went back to fishing. It's what they knew. It's what they were called from. It's who they were. It's what Jesus called them out of to come and follow him. And now Jesus was killed and then he was resurrected, but they haven't seen him for a while. And so the natural next step for them seemed to be, "Well, I'll just go back to what I've always known. I'll just go back to that life that's easy and that's comfortable." But Jesus didn't come so that we might have a life that's easy and that's comfortable. He came so that we might be saved out of whatever life we've created for ourselves that is stealing our focus from him. "Peter, I know that's comfortable for you, and I know you get that, and I know you have success in that, but do you love me more than you love this life that you've created for yourself?" Think about the things in your life that are easy, that are comfortable. I'm not saying that they are necessarily wrong things, but the question stands for all of us. Do you love me more than you love this life that you've created for yourself? Because sometimes the place of comfort can be our greatest hindrance to experiencing the fullness that Jesus has for us. Not that he even necessarily would want to strip that life away from you, but just that he might want you to begin by considering, do you love that life more than you love the one who gave life to you? Secondly, if we consider it this way, Peter, do you love me more than these guys love me? We tend to operate in a world of comparison. And it's no different when we consider faith. Even if you are in a place where you are struggling, even if you are in a place where you feel like, you know what, I just keep giving myself back to the same thing that God is trying to call me out of. We have this tendency to back up from that and look around us and say, but you know what? I'm doing a lot better than that guy over there. Like, I don't emotionally abuse the people in my life. Or I don't cheat at my job. Or I don't have this addiction that this person has. And so, you know, if I can say that about myself in comparison to other people, then I can feel pretty good about myself. Leighton Ford said last week that we don't get to sit in the judgment seat and on the witness stand at the same time. That we cannot be both judge and witness. There is only one who has earned the right to be judge. And it is the one who gave his life, the one who is asking Peter this question. And all we are being invited to do is to bear witness to the fact that though he would be able to hold judgment against us, because of the penalty that he paid on the cross, there is no judgment that now stands before us. He has removed it all. And we are invited to bear witness to that fact, that God's grace means that I am not treated as my sins would determine that I am. But instead, I've been forgiven and invited into new life. So be careful when you begin to consider your love for Jesus in comparison to the way that you feel like other people are loving Jesus. When he looks at you, he sees you. He's not worried about what everyone else is doing. He's not worried about how you stack up next to everyone else. He wants to know, do you love me? Are you willing to bear witness to what I've done in your life and allow me to sit in the judgment seat? And then thirdly, if we consider it this way, Peter, do you love me more than you love these guys? The ones that you've spent the last 3 years with, the ones that you have rallied together with, the ones that you did go into hiding with, but the ones that you walked with as you journeyed with me, do you love me more than you love these guys? Are there people in your life, or is there someone in your life that inhibits you giving yourself fully to the Lord? And I get it. It's easy. People are right in front of us. They're tangible. We can touch them. We can speak to them. We can embrace them. We can sit down with them. We can spend time with them. I get that. It's easy to replace that relationship with Jesus with another person, or it's easy to supplement it. Because we get tired of feeling like our prayers are falling on deaf ears. We get tired of feeling like I believe this, I read it, and I know that it's supposed to be real for me, but I don't, where is Jesus? And so we begin to find love and acceptance in other places and in other people. And is it wrong for us to love other people? No, we are invited to, we are called to, we are created as creatures who are meant to be in relationship with one another. But not before we are created to be in relationship with the one who created us. Every expression of love that you should have in your life, everything that you are able to offer in love and your understanding of what love is should flow and be filtered through the love that you have for and are willing to receive from Christ first. These are hard questions for us to consider. Do you love me more than you love your life? Do you love me more than other people love me? Do you love me more than you love the people in your life? Sometimes Jesus will strip some of those things away from us because they truly are a hindrance. But sometimes he wants to use those things to teach us that our life is not worth more than he is to us. Or that we should strive to answer that question, yes, I love you, and I don't know about other people, but I want to love you in the best way that I can. Or to be able to say, Lord, I love people, but it's because I love you first, and you've taught me what it means to love others well. The second thing that we have to learn from this, and the fact that Jesus questions Peter three times. They're standing on a beach. There's a fire. When was the last time that Peter was in the presence of a fire burning that we know about? I wonder if the smell of the coal burning brought to memory the point of his denial of Jesus. And isn't it beautiful that that is the place where Jesus chooses to begin this interaction with Peter, right at the point of the memory of Peter's denial, right on the shore of Peter's shame. That is where Jesus is willing to meet us. That is where he is standing and waiting at the point of our failure, at the point of our denial, at the point of choosing other things over him, at the point of saying that, you know what, the love that I'm finding from this person, it really feels better than the love that you have for me, Jesus, even though it's going to fall short every single time. Jesus is willing to meet us at that point when we get to the end of ourselves. He's willing to meet us at that point when we've exhausted all other options. He's willing to meet us at the point when we've tried people and things and come up short every time. Jesus, that is standing there waiting for us. At the point of our shame, at the point of our failure, at the point of our disappointment, that's where he's waiting for Peter. Fire burning, because Jesus knows, he remembers, and he wants Peter to remember, because then the next thing that he tells him is going to mean even more to him. Peter, do you love me? Yes. Then guess what? I want you to be a part of what I'm doing. Peter, do you love me? Yes, you know I love you. Guess what? I want you to be a part of what I'm doing. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know I love you. Then guess what? You get to be a part of what I'm doing in this world. You get to tell other people. You get to share my love with other people. You get to share what you have experienced with other people. N.T. Wright says this, by way of forgiveness, Jesus gives Peter a job to do. Peter is not simply being given a jersey and told, like, hey, you know what, you're on the team, but we don't really need you. So if you could just warm the bench, that'd be great. Just be an encourager for the rest of the guys. No, Peter is being put smack in the middle of the work that Jesus has come to do. It is an expression of Christ's love for us that he would invite us into a place where we return that love by serving him and being a part of the work that he is doing in this world. Jesus did not go through sin and death simply to come and give you a pat on the back. Jesus went through sin and death to come and call you into life with him and the work that he is doing in this world. He doesn't seek you out on the shore of your guilt and shame just to make you more proficient at the things you have always done. He sought you out so that he might call you into something new. Not the way you've always lived, not the life you've always known, but into a life where you are walking with him. Follow me, he says to Peter. Imagine what that first step felt like for Peter. And then look at what happens later. If we were to flip over to the book of Acts, and the first Pentecost message that is preached to 3,000 Peter comes from whose mouth? Or 3,000 people comes from whose mouth? Peter's. The one who is arrested and beaten and thrown in jail for preaching in a public place. And then as soon as he's let out, goes straight back to that place is who? Peter. Come and be a part of what I'm doing. I love you, I've forgiven you, I've restored you, now come and be a part of what I'm doing. Let's don't waste any more time in the boat with the nets. That's great, do that on your day off, but come and spend time doing what I am doing. Because there are people that need to hear this message that I met you at the point of your shame, and that I met you at the point of your failure, and I've forgiven you, and I've called you into new life. And you might say, wait, okay, that's great, but where's the flock that Jesus has given me to tend? What's right in front of you? What is right in front of you? Are you a mom who stays at home, who gets to raise children, who gets to raise up a new generation of Jesus followers? Who gets to provide a stable environment for your kids, then that's your flock. What's right in front of you? Are you washing dishes at a restaurant that you don't want to be washing dishes at? Rubbing shoulders with cooks? You know, like, I mean, I've cooked. I've washed dishes. Maybe some of you have cooked and you've washed dishes. If you cook in a restaurant, you know, like, there's something a little crazy about people who work in the kitchen and restaurants. But they need Jesus just like the rest of us. And what's right in front of you? Are you a student? Man, sit in that classroom and learn to the glory of God and pay attention to who's around you. Are you nearing retirement? Retire to the glory of God and then look at what's around you. Where are my sheep? What is my flock? What has God placed in your life? And who has He surrounded you with? I'm going to close with this. This week, many of you may have received in the mail or an email news that our senior pastor, Jason, will be moving. June 28th will be his last Sunday here with us, and we're asking him to preach all three services that Sunday because we believe it's important for us as a church to hear from him on that day. Jason is being appointed to the chair of homiletics and hermeneutics. Basically, he's going to be in charge of teaching seminary students how to preach and how to share this message. He and his family will be moving to Vancouver. Well, he will be the chair of this department, Vancouver Theological Seminary. And I've been a part of this church since the fall of 98, and this is now the fourth time that I've walked through a pastor leaving. And it is hard every single time. It doesn't get easier. Someone who has invested in us as a church, someone who has supported this worshiping family that is Crossroads, someone who has pushed Luke Edwards out the door in the best way possible so that he might start King Street Church, someone who has invested in our Todd campus at Blackburn's Chapel, someone who has invested in us as a church, we get to watch them leave, and that's difficult. But he's going to equip and train other people in a place where the gospel needs to be proclaimed with excellence. And I cannot think of a better person to do that than Jason Biasi. So Jason and his family will be here for a couple more months, and we get to enjoy them and celebrate them, and we get to allow Jason to continue to lead us for those months, and then someone else will come in. And I can tell you that every time I've seen this happen, without fail, I've been able to step back and say, God, you truly are sovereign, and you truly love your church. Jason is tending the sheep that God has placed in front of him. He is being obedient to the call that the Lord has laid on his life and that of his family. And I'm so thankful to get to witness that. And I'm so thankful for his leadership, and I'm so thankful for his friendship. And I'm so thankful that he's not leaving today. But when he's in here on the 28th, Jason, cover your ears. He's standing in the back of the room. When he's in here on the 28th, we're going to send him out in Crossroads style. So come, be here, listen to his message, but then we're going to surround him and his family, and we're going to pray for him. Because we believe that they're going on God's leading, and we want them to go with our blessing. And I'm thankful that we get to see this played out. Follow me. Feed my sheep. Look at the things that I've placed in front of you, and do those things, because that's what it looks like to answer the question from Jesus: do you love me? Please stand and pray.